Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Good morning. Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stash Zielkowski.
We are your storytelling co-hosts. We're so happy you're joining us this morning. This radio show is being pre-recorded to broadcast on Monday, January 28th, 2019. And our theme today is changing perspective. Hi, Stosh.
Hi, Fanny.
How are you today?
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
I'm glad and you are delighted to be
here. Yeah. It's always fun to spend time with you.
Thank you.
Talking into a microphone or riding in the car or,
And generally having a blast.
Yes.
I wanted to say thank you to Andy Offit Irwin, who introduces our show most weeks. That's Andy singing Tarry Here, his original song. And if you don't know Andy Offit Irwin, you should look him up. Google him, because he's a funny guy with such a big heart and writes a lot of wonderful songs and tells amazing stories. And if you're in the mood for laughter and truth, with a capital T, you want to listen to Andy Offit Irwin.
Wow.
That's my little Andy testimonial for the week.
That's very good. Andy should give you some that should give you some bonus points for that.
Oh, Andy gives me bonus points all the time, but that's another conversation. Okay, so today, on the theme of changing perspective, we should change our perspective a bit and talk about the Speak Story series.
All right. Let's see. News about the Speak Story series.
Well, there's the February fundraiser that we want everybody to know about.
Coming up February 10th at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Community Center in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And it is a fundraiser to support the Speak Story series, and a modest cost of $35. There will be a performance by Emmy Award-winning storyteller Jim May, who is not only a storyteller but an author. He has a couple of wonderful books out there. And there will be a silent auction that night. And Adam Booth, the founder of Speak Story Series, after Jim performs about a 45-minute to 50-minute set, Adam and Jim will have a discussion about storytelling and about the way Jim goes about his career and his storytelling. And I'm pretty sure they'll have some question and answer with the audience also. So that is February 10th.
And that's where they will unveil the roster for season 7. Is that correct?
They will tell who is going to appear each month. And they will make some dates. They're normally...
Whoa, are we having Law and Order?
Yes. Normally those dates are the second Tuesday of each month. But because of conflicts, the storytellers that they have coming in, sometimes there are conflicts with their schedule. And so that it'll have to be adjusted to maybe the third Tuesday of the month. Mm-hmm. And so that will also be revealed, the specific dates. And because Jim May is in town, he will be staying at my house in Sharpsburg. And he is going to be doing a workshop on February 9th from 1 to 5 at my house. And the workshop will help you with stories in lots of ways. And it's not just to help with stories. It's going to tie your family stories and maybe even what you do as a profession along with some myths and a guide for you to be able to tell your stories in a better way.
I'm guessing it'll also make us all better listeners.
Oh, I'm sure, because Jim is excellent.
And he's an excellent listener.
He's fantastic, really. I have done a couple of workshops with him. In Pittsburgh, he was at our house and did a workshop 2 years ago. I've been to his workshop in Oaxaca, Mexico, a week-long intensive, which was wonderful. One of the things that I really like about Jim when he's doing his work is that if we had a class in Mexico scheduled to begin at 9 o'clock, according to his watch, at 9 o'clock, he would begin each class with a small story. And so if you weren't where you're supposed to be at 9 o'clock, you would miss out on the story. And often those stories were real gifts because they were the kind of thing you'd like to have if you were, oh, say you were a either a teacher or a storyteller who worked in schools, often would like to have a couple of short stories to start off with the kids to get them in the mood or to get them settled down. So anyway, Jim May, 1 to 5 at Sharpsburg at my home. And you could call me for information about that, more details, at 501-253-4656.
I'll be sure to call you and tell you that I'm coming.
Okay, I'll make a note. I'll look for your call. I hope I don't forget it.
I've already told you that I'm coming to that workshop.
That's right.
Wouldn't miss it. Good. Jim May's one of my favorites.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Shall we start with a story?
Yes.
Do you want to start, or would you like me to start?
Why don't you start?
Okay. This is on the theme of changing perspective.
Look at you all prepared.
Oh, Stosh, I am always prepared. It's just not visible, even to me. This story is called The Creek That Listened. Once upon a time, there was a fast-moving, twisting little creek that rushed along a muddy stream bed that ran through a forested valley. Most of the time, this creek enjoyed her travels through the tall trees and smaller saplings that made up the deep, quiet woods. Most of the time, the only sound the fast-moving creek was aware of was the sound of her own rushing water. Once in a while, when she paused to catch her breath, she could hear other sounds. Birds singing in the trees overhead. That was apparently a bird with asthma. The rustling and scratching of mice and shrews and other small beings looking for food under the fallen leaves and ground vines that spread across the forest floor. The softer, almost silent padding of a fox stepping along a fallen log looking for crayfish under rocks along the creek's very own banks. Whenever she heard these sounds, she would almost, but not quite, stop running along the muddy stream bed so that she could listen. Now, that only lasted a few seconds because this creek just lived to run, splashing over rocks in the stream bed, crashing around large boulders, and making those quick turns as the Earth tried to block her way. The only other thing that ever made the creek pause her running and rushing was a single worry. The creek knew that her job was to find the sea. Finding a lake or a river would be fine, too, because the water in either of those would eventually find its way to the sea. Whenever she remembered that she was searching for the sea, her forward movement would slow. It made her sad to think she really had no idea at all how to find the sea, and that made her doubt that any river or lake could know any more than she did about how to find the sea. She couldn't completely stop her forward movement. Water, after all, seeks its lowest point. The creek would remember that she just had to keep searching, and her rushing and running would speed up as she rushed on. Then one day, she became aware that in addition to all the animals, the fox and the mouse and the shrew and the birds who lived in the forest, there was another great and powerful presence there. The forest itself was a sort of being, like the creek herself, composed of many trees, just as the creek was composed of many, many drops of water. When that thought occurred to her, she slowed down to a mere trickle. She stopped so suddenly, her water made a sort of a wall or a wave that rose up and spilled over the creek banks. But then she started trickling again as she had a second thought. The forest was big and tall, so wide and so very, very old, older than the oldest tree still standing, for trees had been growing there for thousands and thousands of years. And she, the creek, could ask the forest how she might find the sea. And so she did. In a very small, humble voice, barely more than a whisper, she said out loud, "Oh, great forest, can you tell me, the creek of this valley, where or how I might find the sea?" When she had finished asking the question, she stayed as still and quiet as she ever had in her whole life, waiting and listening to see if the forest would answer. She heard, birds singing in the trees overhead, the rustling and scratching of mice and shrews and other small beings looking for food under the fallen leaves and ground vines that spread across the forest floor. The softer, almost silent padding of a fox stepping along a fallen log, looking for crayfish under rocks along the creek's very own banks. She listened to these sounds for a long time. She was just about to return to her running and rushing, a bit sad that the forest had not answered her, when she heard, a murmur in the trees above her, the sound of a thousand trees shaking their leaves, swaying their branches, as if to say, "You are water. You have this information in your heart, and all you need to do is listen. Do you know how to listen?" "Oh, yes," said the fast-moving, twisting little creek. "I know how to listen to these sounds." Birds singing in the trees overhead. The rustling and scratching of mice and shrews and other small beings looking for food under the fallen leaves and ground vines that spread across the forest floor. The softer, almost silent padding of a fox along a fallen log looking for crayfish under rocks along my very own banks. Haunt the forest. Laughed at that very quietly. But it was a laugh all the same, and the fast-moving, twisting little creek listened carefully to that laugh, too. And then the forest said, "We think you are a good listener. You must practice listening so that you can hear the sound of the sea deep in your heart, but also out in the world. If you listen carefully, and often the sound of the sea will become clearer to you, and soon you will find that you can tell which inclines to tumble down, which logs to jump over, and which boulders to go around to find your way to the sea. "But I've never heard the sea," said the fast-moving, twisting little creek. "I don't know how to listen for the sea."
"Well, you have to listen for far away sounds. Bird songs and rustling and padding feet you hear are right next to you. Try listening to far away sounds."
But what is a far away sound?"
"A sound that comes slowly, with more waiting, more patience. You must listen for sounds you've never heard before. The sounds of the sea have been there all along, but you haven't heard them yet."
Well, the fast-moving, twisting little creek thanked the forest for that advice and began practicing her listening skills immediately. She practiced all day long for 71,000 days in a row, and it was not too long after that that she found she could very faintly hear the gentle slap of waves on sand and shore, the cries of seagulls, the crash of higher waves when storms came to push and pull the water into tall white waves in the sea, and the sound of wind on water. And so the fast-moving, twisting little creek listened and learned, following the sounds of water and waves and wind and seagulls, till she came to the wide, wide, wide sea. But you know, and the fast-moving, twisting little creek quickly learned, that for every drop of water that enters the sea, other drops of water are carried from the sea up into the air above it, and the wind blows those drops of water back across the land, and eventually they fall again as rain into the creeks and rivers and lakes, and the journey starts again. So the fast-moving, twisting little creek listened to the sea and listened for the rain and the birds and the rustling and scratching mice and shrews and the padding of a fox looking for his breakfast, and sometimes even the laughing, whispering forest. And life was good.
Wow. I like that.
I like it too.
Great. I could be using a classroom to teach the water cycle.
It could be. I think I'm going to include that in my water cycle set.
There you go. That's good. That was delightful. And the sound effects
were quite amusing.
Were interesting.
I had that titmouse call down perfectly at home. I don't know why. What's wrong with my whistle?
I don't know. Could be the atmosphere. You don't live in West Virginia, right?
Well, maybe, but I have titmice at my home.
I know.
And I don't live in West
Virginia. Crossing the state line may affect your whistler.
I've got to work on it. And those titmice abandoned me.
And the rustling of the things?
The rustling of the mice and the shrews?
It scared me at one time. The first time I heard I thought a forest fire had started.
Oh, my. Well, maybe I need a different set of scratchy leaves.
No, it might be just me, but it was scary.
Whoa. Well, that's not a bad thing. It made you pause.
There. So, you're listening to enlightenradio.org, the Storytelling Hour, from Bolivar, West Virginia. And that was Fanny Crawford, who told a delightful story
called The Creek That Listened.
The Creek That Listened.
On the theme of...
Boy, that would be so good in so many classrooms. Really. For little children, mm-hmm. to teach them the skill of listening and to be able to talk about listening to the sounds in the hallway or the sounds outside.
You can use that story anytime you like.
I like it very much. That would be neat, you know, because the listening to distant sounds is important.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, there's so many nice things you could teach kids with that.
Well, and to teach also that you have a choice about what you listen to, right. Although it's sometimes difficult to maintain your choice. You do have some control.
Right. And some people are very good about selecting what they'll listen to.
Yeah, and some people have a really hard time.
I'm guessing some marriage counselors could tell us about selective listening.
Indeed. Not, you don't have to be a marriage counselor.
No, another counselor.
Have a story about selective listening.
Right. So that's great.
Okay, well, I'm going to say a couple words about the Stories in the Round series. And I do love to talk about Andy Offit Irwin and to repeat that he's coming back for the third year in a row to Stories in the Round, but that won't be till August. That's the third Monday in August. I can't remember what the number of the day is.
The 19th.
Thank you, Mr. Numbers Guy. That's not an insult. That's an admirable quality that you remember the numbers. We're March through December, usually the fourth Mondays, but there are exceptions to that. And you can call me at 301-730-1638 or email me at fanitsky@hotmail.com, fanitsky@hotmail.com. And maybe by the time you make your phone call or send your email, I'll actually know more about the roster for the coming year. Okay, it's time for another story. Are you going to tell us a story, Stosh?
Yes.
Oh, good. I wondered.
And here's a question. I just thought of a question for you. What storyteller has appeared at Stories in the Round more times than Andy Offit Irwin?
Adam Booth. If you just mean appear... Like, show his face at the microphone. No, that's not what you mean?
No, I mean actually
performed. Who has performed more than Andy Offit Irwin? Well, Andy Offit Irwin has only been there twice, I believe.
Right, and this time will be his third, but somebody else has performed.
So Andy's coming for again this season at You're talking about Speak or Stories in the Round?
Stories in the Round.
Oh, Stories in the Round. I'm sorry. I got that selective hearing as
there
we were
go.
Talking about. Yeah. It must be Stosh Zielkowski.
It is.
Whoa!
I just realized that.
More than me, even. No. Yes.
Have you performed at Stories in the Round?
I have. Once. And then twice in the play.
Three times
in the play. So the same
tied.
Number. We're tied.
How about that?
Okay.
How about that? Isn't that wonderful to find that out?
That we have that in common, yes.
Yes. So, that's great.
Well, we should like Car Talk and the Tappet Brothers on NPR, we should have a question of the week. And
that's right.
There'd be a prize if the first caller to call in with the correct answer.
Right. Wow.
We'll hang up on them. That will be the prize. Okay.
I think we're having far too much fun here.
Yeah, but my husband says I'm getting mean in my dotage.
Oh, well, I don't think that's true, but I won't disagree with my friend Jose.
Okay. Story time.
Okay, so I'm not sure if I told any of this story on the air before, but you probably have heard it since we talk all the time. In 1970, I was teaching. I began teaching at a public high school. I had taught my first few years at a private school, and for a number of reasons, I left and went to the public school system. One of the main reasons was an incredible $2,000, $3,000 raise in pay from $7,000 to $10,000 a year. My father was so impressed because it had taken him forever in his job to get near $10,000 a year. Some of my friends' parents were really impressed that here I was just 30 years old, not quite 30 years old, and already I was making $10,000 a year. It didn't seem like a whole lot to me, but I always had some pocket change, and I could always put food on the table, so, and I drove, I had a car. Anyway, in that year, I became a track coach. I coached indoor track, the boys' indoor track team, and I became an assistant to the outdoor track coach. And there were girls in the school who wanted to run track, but they weren't allowed to because there was no such thing as a girls' track program in the county, so the schools couldn't have one. And I sought permission to start a girls' track team and was told no. And conversation lasted just about that long. So I did investigate using the track for a girls' track club. And I was given permission that I could use the track. Of course, I didn't even have to ask because any citizen of the of that community could just go to use the track once the teams weren't using it. And so I began a girls' track club, and we met after boys' practice. So I coached the boys, and then when the boys were finished and the track was cleared, the girls could use the track. And we had lots of fun. I took the girls to some, at the time they were called, there was Amateur Athletic Union, AAU, meets, and it was outside of school activity. I didn't have to, but for the sake of being a, you know, responsible adult, I got permission slips signed by the parents so that I could take the girls in my car. And we went to a number of track meets, and the girls did pretty well, and it was interesting. Well, the next year, I thought we should do indoor track. I was told no there. And so that was 1971-72 school year. In the 1972-73 school year, I used a different perspective about girls' track. I had made some objections to the indoor track meeting with the male coaches in my first 2 years. And in my second year of coaching indoor track and being involved with the indoor track coaches, which were all male and their athletes were all male, the man who was in charge, he had a really nice man by the name of Sam. Near the end of the meeting, he said, I'm going to make a proposal. I'm not going to be in charge of the track program for the county anymore. And I would like our new man, who always seems to have ideas, to take over. And it was unanimous. They made me, put me in charge of the boys' indoor track program in Baltimore County. And that covered a whole bunch of schools. We had, I believe at the time we had 18 or 19 schools. Well, I got another new perspective. Driving home one evening, before the indoor track season actually began, and before the first meeting of that year, an idea came to me. And so, when I got home, I wrote a nice memo to myself. And at the first indoor track meeting in 1972-73, I announced that we didn't have any choice anymore. There would be girls in the track program, and they would be in the same program with the boys. However, as a beginning, they would only have four events. The boys' track program had a lot more than four events. Quite a number, up in the teens. But I relayed to the other coaches that I had been given instructions that the girls' track team would be just ride along with the boys to the events. And we did most of our events in community college tracks or in the National Guard Armory in Baltimore. And so the coaches just shrugged their shoulders, and some of them were quite happy because they could go back to their schools and announce that there would be a girls' track program. And so it worked. And we had a number of meets, just individual meets against, like we'd have a meet between Franklin High School and Lock Raven High School, and the other teams would have a meet between two schools, and that, all on the same day at the National Guard Armory, most of our meets, and everyone seemed to really enjoy it. Even the grumpy kind of old-fashioned coaches who didn't think girls belonged in the sport started enjoying the races. I felt bad for the girls because they, at first, no one said anything about uniforms, and I had forgotten that little item. But the girls in a number of schools, on their own initiative, came up with uniforms that were acceptable and quite modest compared to the uniforms that female track athletes wear today. I don't think some of those coaches that I worked with back in the 70s would have been able to escape a heart attack had the girls walked out onto the track in some of the things that we see them now, even running in marathons. So anyway, the indoor season went along very well in that year, 1972-73 school year, until about 2 weeks before the county championships, when I received a phone call from a Mrs. Murray, who happened to be the supervisor of all athletics in Baltimore County, both male and female. And Mrs. Murray requested that I tell her who gave me permission to have girls track in the indoor program. And I told her I couldn't remember who sent me the memo, but it came from her office. And I said, I got a call at school, and the secretary wrote down the information and said, this is from Mrs. Murray's office, and she's in charge of all the sports. So I said, well, who am I to question Mrs. Murray? Well, she said, Mrs. Murray did not send you a memo. And I said, well, I don't know who it was then. At the end of the season, after the championship, and of course the girls did not go on past the county championship because there was no girls program in the state then, I was summoned to appear in Mrs. Murray's office. And I got a dressing down, but in a polite way, in a very nice way. She informed me that if I had done this on my own and started a program that was not legal in the county, I could have been in serious trouble. I could have lost my job. But since I had gotten this call and the memo that everything was okay, but she asked me if I would please come to see her when she would send for me about an indoor track, an outdoor track program for the girls, because she thought maybe my experience of this first year would be helpful in talking to some of the female athletics teachers, the gym teachers, who would be interested in girls track. And as I got up to leave, I think, I can't be sure because I never asked her, but I believe not only did she have a smile on her face, but she winked as I said goodbye.
Wow. So you changed hearts and minds all over Baltimore County, including at the state level.
Oh, I guess. I even have a trophy that I've kept, which is a different kind of, we mentioned trophies before. This trophy is a booklet that lists all the girls' teams that ran in the outdoor girls' track and field championship, which was separate from indoor track and was held, I forget the name of the school where it was held, but it was through Mrs. Murray's work. And it was in 1974. And in that program, every school that competed there, it's listed the name of the school, the letters that they use for identification instead of the entire school name was used in the program, like Catonsville was CAT, Franklin was FRA, things like that. And next to the Franklin High School name, the coach is S. Ziolkowski. And if you look at the list of coaches there, there are no other men on that list. And only women were supposed to be coaching girls at that time. But the woman who, at Franklin, was assigned to coach the girls, knew nothing about track, and was glad to have S. Ziolkowski run the practices and write up the workouts. And even though he wasn't allowed to go on the bus with the girls to track meets, he could drive his car and arrive at the meets and take care of the girls as far as coaching them during the meet. In the state meet, they had a gathering of all coaches before the meet to go over the rules. And as the woman in charge was beginning, she asked politely, "Excuse me, can you tell me why you're in here?" Pointing at me. And I said, "I'm the coach of a team." And she said, "You must be kidding. That's not possible." I said, "Oh, yes, it is." I said, "And in fact, a person who was in that room could vouch for me, and did. It was Mrs. Murray."
What a great coda to the story.
Yeah, it was super.
Oh, my. What a rogue you are.
No, I just use different perspectives.
On the theme of different perspectives, right. Yeah. There's nothing like a rebel to get things done.
Well.
Change the world.
Yeah. Somebody sometimes needs to do something different. And I never expected that I wouldn't get caught.
You never expected you wouldn't get caught?
Oh, I thought I was going to, I thought I'd get caught after one or two meets at the first indoor season. I seriously, you know, when we went to the Army, I thought sooner or later, Mrs. Murray's going to show up, or somebody, or an athletic director from another school is going to show up and say, "What's going on here?" And, But they didn't, because there were a lot of people, including
Mrs. Murray,
and a government program that began in 1972 called Title IX.
That said, if you're going to take our money.
Said, and if you don't mind, I'd like to add a little bit to this story.
Oh, please.
Okay. So I was in charge of the Baltimore County track program, indoor track program. And along with that, I became the meet director of the National Guard Invitational, which was put on by the National Guard at their National Guard armory. Well, the National Guard Invitational was a big deal in indoor track because they invited schools from the entire state. It was an all-day-long indoor track meet. The medals that they gave out were beautiful, all paid for by the National Guard units. Well, in 73, the winter of 73-74, the National Guard meet was always in January. So this would have been in the January of 74. But in the fall of 73, I went to the National Guard and had a meeting, which I'd done the previous 2 years, with the general, who was in charge of... and the meeting with the general was very simple. We shook hands, and he thanked me for promoting the work of the National Guard with young people and said he would do his best to be at the meet. He didn't make many of the meets. He was busy and always would then turn me over to the captain, who did the real work on the meet. It so happened that the athletic director from our school went to this meeting with me. He was curious about how this worked because he had just been made the athletic director the year before, and he had not been involved with indoor track. So while we were sitting at the meeting going over the events, they didn't ever change here the year, except this year we were going to put in the pole vault, which was, you know, it was always a good event. But indoor track, you needed to have a place, you needed to have special equipment. And they put in, and on the spur of the moment, because I had read an article about Title IX, I looked at the captain and I said, "Captain, before we go over the expenses, I need to tell you about Title IX." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, it's a new program. And, you know, Title IX now says that in schools where they have athletic programs for boys, they have to have equal athletic programs for girls." And just with that, this was a man who was used to going by the rules. And actually, he was very respectful to me because I ran the meet, and he would like not to have done that. So there's a lot of paperwork, a lot of work the day of the meet. And he said, "Oh my goodness, so that means we have to get two sets of medals." I said, "Yes." But I said, "But the girls won't be running the exact same events, so I can give you a list of the events." He said, "Well, do that right now. I have to make a phone call." He called somebody who he said later was the finance officer, and he said, I don't remember the guy's name, but it was a really great phone call. So something like, "Larry, you won't believe this. We have to spend twice as much money on the medals for the National Guard Army because of Title IX. Well, you haven't heard of Title IX? It means we have to treat girls just like we treat the boys." Well, when we left, Dr. Bruce, William Bruce, who was a nice guy, he and I didn't always see eye to eye, but he was a nice man and good athletic director in lots of ways. And also the first tall basketball player in the Maryland area. He played at Western Maryland College, and he was about 6'10". And that in those days, that would have been a giant on the court. Well, I had driven, and we got in my car one way, and he said, you know, it's funny. I would think I would have gotten something about the Title IX business. You know, I said, well, it's new. And I said, maybe the county just hasn't sent it out to everybody about all this stuff. It was all true. But no one had ever intended a National Guard meet to have girls in it. And so that year and every year since, the girls get to run in that meet.
Woohoo! Thanks, Coach.
Yeah. And I really didn't think I'd get away with that one either. But since the Army did it, the National Guard, since they provided money, anybody who would have objected would have run into a really large stone wall.
Well, it provided such validity, such leverage for anybody that was having trouble with their own administrations.
Absolutely.
If you know, the military is doing it.
Right. You know, and the military was providing all the money. And it was a great place to do that.
That's great. Thank you. I love that one. I've heard bits of that story before, but never the full story and all the little codas that you have added on. So you can do almost a full hour on Title IX in Maryland.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I often feel bad for the people who are stuck with so many rules and regulations. And it's one of the reasons that I usually am not in favor of committees and things like that. Too many. What's that saying? Too many cooks
spoil the broth.
You bet. So.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try to squeeze in a story in the remaining time. I think I can do it. We're still on the theme of changing perspective. And this story came out of recognizing that at certain times in my childhood, my perspective on my family or individual family members changed a bit over time. So this one's called The Rag Picker's Rules.
I like it already.
I'm a storyteller. Sometimes I even get paid for this work, and then I call myself a professional storyteller. But I also run a booth in an antique mall, and I have a flea market stall for lesser treasures. And I think of myself as the rag picker's daughter. The Philadelphia rag picker's daughter, because I come by both of my current vocations, or I guess you can call them, the traditional way. My dad was a finder and a storyteller. So antiques and less grandiose rummage was never valuable only for its practical value, its practical use. If the item in question came with a story, or you could imagine a story that fit, that could be offered to potential listeners. Now that was a real find. As a small child, I started out as an introvert, an introverted child, my mother's daughter, the librarian's child. But not for long, because Daddy got right to work on that as soon as he realized that I was tempted or kneeling. A little bit of dyslexia there. Leaning towards shyness. The first bit of advice I ever remember my dad giving me. One day, as we were walking home together, he nodded and said hello to someone on the street. I did not. And he looked at me after the other person passed and said,
Why didn't you speak to that neighbor? I don't know them, I said, probably with a bit of an edge in my voice, recognizing after the fact that I had broken a rule I didn't even know existed. Doesn't matter, he said. If you pass someone in the neighborhood, you speak. Philadelphia rag pickers rule number one. Greet the people you meet as you move about the town each day. Someday, you're going to need those people. You want them to know you care about them. When I was very little, Daddy found and brought home huge boxes of hand-me-down kids' clothes, sometimes from the rummage sale, but most often from friends of our family whose kids were a bit older than me and my baby brother. I cannot adequately express how much I loved those boxes of clothes. The families that the clothes came from lived way on the other side of town, or maybe in a different town, but I never saw them. I only vaguely knew who they were. So there was no worry on my part that someone would see me in their cast-off clothes. And there were no strings attached. By the time I was even aware of the huge boxes of hand-me-down kids' clothes, my parents were letting me sort through them on my own, try them on, decide what I wanted, what I didn't want. And since my little brother was 5 years younger than me, we were rarely in competition for the same clothes. Although I do remember a Davy Crockett raccoon skin cap with a tail that gave me pause. But I had big sister status that I had to maintain, and I had to let that cap go. Later on, Daddy found all kinds of things. A brand new, still in the box, unpainted oak vintage Hoosier kitchen cabinet, you know, the kind with the big double doors on top, a porcelain pull-out tabletop in the middle that slides out, and a big single door covering a double shelf underneath the table. Daddy said it came from one of his cronies, somebody from Buildings and Grounds at the University of Pennsylvania down the street from Daddy's bookstore, used bookstore. Another time, he brought home four separate stacked towers of glass and oak barrister bookcases. Each tower, each set, had four or five cases stacked high on a 12-inch base. Those were gorgeous, and I still have both the Hoosier cabinet and all those barrister bookcases in my house. Rag picker's rule, Philadelphia rag picker's rule number two, reuse, recycle, and pass it on. Well, every summer, my dad packed us into our vintage automobile of the moment. From the green, I think, 1944 Plymouth, I was pretty young, all the way to the battered gray Chrysler van my parents used for the used book business. Daddy was taking us up into the Pennsylvania mountains and into western New York, Portville, Olean, Jamestown, Buffalo, for our annual visit to his brothers and sisters and their kids, our cousins. This was my favorite time of the year, my favorite place on earth. I thought of those green mountains and those slower-paced towns as paradise. And I was maybe in my 20s when it finally occurred to me that I needed those aunts and uncles and my dozens of first, second, and third cousins far more than they needed me. They had each other all year round. Most of them lived within 50 miles of each other. They were always friendly to me, and they seemed happy to see us every summer. But I knew in my heart of hearts that most of the year, they never thought about me at all. That had never occurred to me before. I lived 8 hours away on those two-lane roads in the mountains in gritty, filthy Delphia, as they called it. And I recognized at that point that if I wanted to continue to be part of this family, this huge extended family, beyond the introduction that my dad gave me, I needed to be needed. It was up to me to act like I cared about them. My dad showed me that wealth is not always measured in dollars, income, or other resources to meet those minimal needs for food, shelter, and clothing. It might be a prerequisite for peace of mind and the freedom to choose how to spend your time. Many wisdom keepers have noticed that true wealth comes in the form of loyal friends, family members who respect and honor your true self, work collaborators or shareholders in your chosen field who support and honor the products of your labor. But perhaps the most important wealth includes the capacity for introspection and growth. Philadelphia Ragpickers Rule Number 3. Listen and learn the stories of your community. Listen, learn, and pass it on.
Wonderful. Philadelphia Ragpickers Rule.
Three of them.
But so who's the ragpicker?
My dad.
Your dad.
I'm the ragpicker's daughter.
I see. I like that. I like that. The title, Ragpicker's Daughter, would make a good title for your memoirs.
Yes, exactly. Well, I told this story Tuesday at a Toastmasters meeting, and somebody came up to me afterwards and told me about, he's either an actor or some kind of celebrity who wrote a book called The Ragpicker's Son. So now I have to look that up and maybe read it, or what if it's music? Who?
Kirk Douglas.
Kirk Douglas, that's it. Thank you. I've been trying to remember because I didn't write it down at the time.
Because he called himself the Ragpicker's Son.
Yeah, right. So now I have to find it so I can read it. Well, it's good to know that there's not just a ragpicker's daughter.
So old he is.
Kirk Douglas is 102?
Mm-hmm.
Is he still alive?
That's what his son said recently.
Oh, okay. Well, see, ragpickers live a long time. My dad lived to be 93.
It was his father that was the ragpicker.
Kirk Douglas' father. Okay. Oh, okay. Never mind then. Okay, we are about to close, but I want to mention New Spire Arts because we just had our first of the season New Spire Arts Story Circle in Frederick this past Sunday, and we had a good time. And if you want more information about the next teller and co-hosts and what's scheduled for the year forward, call me Fanny Crawford at 301. You can call me anything you want, but if you want to reach me, you have to call me at 301-730-1638 or email me at Fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com. And we're at the end of our time. So, Stosh.
This is Stosh Siolkowski
and Fanny Crawford,
your co-host for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour,
broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia.
And we're closing out this week's show. Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for
jazz.
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 Let's see.
There we go. Okay.
Are we off?
Yeah. Come on.